Hello, my name's Seth Townsend. I'm passionate about energy reduction, climate change, and new technology that assists organisations reduce their carbon footprint and meet their own sustainability targets. I also happen to be the Energy Marketing Manager at Schneider Electric, so it's great to work for an organisation that helps you indulge in your passion for such a worthwhile cause. The UK is committed to reducing all greenhouse gas emissions to net zero by 2050. Rapid decarbonisation across all sectors is required to achieve this target, and the UK must demonstrate its climate leadership and commitment to net zero by dramatically scaling up its emissions reductions actions. So welcome to the start of the exciting series of monthly podcasts from Schneider Electric in the run-up to COP26, cannily titled The Drive to Net Zero. We have over 40 external speakers booked to discuss the latest in insights and legislation in all things energy reduction, and every month we'll bring the latest cutting-edge information from the people who live and breathe these topics on a daily basis. During these sessions, we'll be investigating the decarbonisation of the network, from clean energy to smart grids, and from energy storage to electrifying the transport network. However, the first few podcasts will focus on e-mobility. Anyway, I am delighted and honoured to announce Alex Sobel MP to join our podcast. Alex is our very first guest on the Drive to Net Zero series and the chairperson of the Net Zero All-Party Parliamentary Group. It's lovely to have you join us, Alex. I was just wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about the Net Zero All-Party Parliamentary Group.
We set this up last summer when we were fairly, it hadn't been announced, but we were fairly confident that the UK was going to host a COP. We sort of launched it after the announcement, but in the build-up. And the idea is that what we want to see is that COP26 in Glasgow next year will provide a net zero settlement and a net zero target. We've got different ideas about dates, to be honest, on the All Party group, but we're all committed to net zero in one form or another. And also, like, although I'm at heart somebody that believes that we should be aiming for net zero in the UK by 2030, we should have that industrial transformation and that transition as quickly as possible. I also understand there are lots of other countries in a very different place and also are on a development path. So actually, globally, having a later date is particularly with countries who've got historically low emissions, is fine. But that's what we're doing. That's what our focus is on the APPG till next November. And it's also about the application of technology, of systems, of looking at things like carbon pricing, of looking at difficult, tricky issues like exported emissions, issues like aviation and shipping, and trying to build a pace within the UK to take COP. And so we've started to engage globally as well, but we're mainly engaging with industry and with government in the UK at the moment.
And do you find from a global perspective, do you think the UK and Ireland are leading it at all, or are there any other countries who are kind of taking a bit of a lead and we're adopting some of their concepts and philosophies about energy reduction?
I think that it's a very mixed picture. So obviously we just had the Global Climate Ambitions Summit, and the UK was at the leading edge of that. And the EU actually were less ambitious. And you can understand that from the history of some of the countries, particularly the accession countries who had very dirty industry, particularly pre-1990, and have been transitioning away from that. But there are countries in the EU who are going further and faster than us. So Denmark's a good example. So, you know, Denmark are in a good position in some areas. For instance, heating, you know, most of Denmark is covered by district heating power. Their wind industry is advanced, and they have much more manufacturing and ownership than we do. But we are, in terms of ambition, we are at the leading edge. But I think that what concerns me, and it also concerns Lord Deben, who is the chair of the Climate Change Committee, and I chaired their MP's launch actually for the CCC carbon budget, is that our targets are in the right place, and are maybe not for me, but for the CCC ambitious enough, but it's the delivery that's the problem. So we're talking the talk, but we're not walking the walk, and we're going to miss our targets unless we significantly up our game in so many areas. And energy is one of those areas that we're probably in a better position in energy than we are in housing or transport. and particularly in shipping and aviation. So, we're not there, and we need to basically have a huge ramping up if we're gonna hit our 56 carbon budget targets.
Okay, so why do you become its chairperson of the All Party Parliamentary Group then for net zero?
So, a new All Party Group. So it works as the person who came up with the idea and who sort of formed it usually becomes the chair. And that was what happened. And then at the time, actually, I was co-chair with Simon Clark, who's a Conservative MP for Middlesbrough, who, though we don't agree on everything, we agree on the pathway, and he's committed to net zero. And so he was co-chair, but then he went into the government. And so he had to, you can't be an all-party group chair if you're a minister.
Okay.
But now he's back out of the government. So maybe in the new year, he'll come back as co-chair. But it is a proper all-party group. We've got a lot of Conservative vice chairs. It isn't. Some sort of personal vehicle of mine.
It's okay. And how do you feel the group is aiding the acceleration of the green industrial revolution?
I think it's bringing policymakers and industry and climate change activists, if you like, or the NGO community together, and is effectively creating a practical space to ramp that up. So we do have, like, for instance, a housing developer, and I'm going to speak to their board in the new year, and it's about influencing industry as well as trying to get the government to ramp up and to introduce tighter legislation, increased subsidies. So, for instance, on low carbon vehicles, I'm very negative about the government, because I think if we're going to meet the pathway, particularly the end of sales of petrol diesel cars in 2030, we need to have a different approach, either Norwegian type approach, which is subsidy driven approach, or another approach which involves benchmarks and pathways along the way, which gives encouragement to people to make the shift.
Okay. So talking a little bit around the power and industry piece, there seems to have been more change in the electricity network in the past 5 years than in the previous 100 years. Yeah. We're seeing kind of more decentralized energy, certainly greener energy generated now, and renewables with consumers starting to produce their own energy as well, but there's also an increased demand of energy as well, which I think is estimated to be over 500 terawatt hours of power by 2050. With this new kind of philosophy and belief, and the right belief for me around wind and solar playing an inherent part in this, how do you feel that's going to work? And also looking at we looked recently around Sizewell C being muted as a potential nuclear generation point. How do you see that whole energy philosophy working? So renewables plus nuclear. Do you think there'll be a push more to nuclear or more to clean energy resource? Or
so there's a lot there. So one, the decarbonisation of energy and what role the electricity grid plays. And it will play a very significant role, but whether it will play 100% of the role is, and whether that's advisable is another matter. Like, my view is that it needs to be split between electricity and hydrogen. And hydrogen's got a big role, particularly in heavy transport, but potentially also in home heating. We've been talking about this in Leeds in particular for, when I was on the council, we started talking about this in 2015. And so we need to think about that. And electricity obviously has a huge role to play in hydrogen production, because ideally, we'd have green hydrogen, which is through electrolysis. And so one of my lobbying points to the government is to create a national infrastructure around electrolyzers, to view them as infrastructure, not to view them as a sort of retail end of the sort of spectrum. But I think that in terms of the energy mix, that there are new and interesting things coming along. What we shouldn't be thinking about is that the entire renewable sector is going to be just domestic solar and solar farms, offshore wind and onshore wind. There's a lot of other things. So we've got, there's hydro in the UK, and then you can use hydro as storage, and we have some of that in Wales. Switzerland has got a huge amount of it, and we have in Scotland, Wales, and actually not that far from us, Leeds, potential for more of that hydro storage. But there is also what I call sort of offshore solar, so putting huge solar farms in Morocco and running undersea cable. And these are all much less risky and actually potentially cheaper per kilowatt hour than nuclear. Nuclear, there's a huge startup cost. There's also all the issues about spent nuclear fuels and the disposal of them. And so, like, we have nuclear power stations and they're part of the mix. And in terms of industrial production, it's important that we have nuclear to replace that to replace coal fire in effect. But in terms of building particularly large new nuclear power, I'm a skeptic. And I think that we should view nuclear as an interim solution for the next 15, 20 years. And so building a very expensive nuclear power station that potentially is around for 30 to 50 years, I think is a poor investment for the UK.
Thanks very much for that. And I guess probably just moving on to transport. Transport is now the biggest source of emissions, 34% of CO2 in 2019. In the Net Zero Decarbonisation Report, there is a will to accelerate the decarbonisation of transport sector by bringing forward the planned ban of the sale of new internal combustion engines, which has been brought forward, which is great, and accelerating the deployment of charging infrastructure. We think there are probably about 330,000 EVs on the road today, but 38 million internal combustion engine vehicles. Why do you think the progress for EV adoption has been so slow, would you say?
So I think there's a number of things. So one is the EV infrastructure. Two, there's the range anxiety issue, which I think we're almost over now. Three is that a lot of people in this country, and I'm one of them, doesn't buy their vehicles new. You know, I think, you know, fleet, you know, there's a lot of fleets in this country. There is a minority of people who buy brand new cars. But the majority of personal car ownership is in the secondhand market. And the secondhand market for EVs hasn't been mature. What we've seen with hybrids is that market's become hugely mature. You know, the Toyota Prius, for example. And so hybrids are now very common on the road. And that was partly to do with fleets as well, because a lot of people switched their fleets to hybrids, and then they went into the secondhand market. And I think that's what's going to happen with EV. So one of the things that can happen is that we need to see better tax breaks on EVs for fleet, and so the fleet market switches much earlier. I mean, the fleet market should be switching now to EVs. The same with the taxi and private hire vehicle market. Obviously, you know, the sort of hackney cab market in London, then all the new ones are EVs pretty much. So that's moving in that direction, although I've got some criticism of how that EV operates. But anyway, and then the other thing is what they've done in Norway. So in Norway, it's cheaper to buy an EV than it is to buy a petrol diesel car. So they don't really need the ban in Norway. I mean, they're making the progress without the ban, and then they're obviously creating a quicker, more mature secondhand market. So I think all of those issues sort of are where we're behind. And actually, our only plans are that we will turn off the switch, if you like, of new petrol and diesel, and we'll improve the infrastructure. And improving the infrastructure is important, but actually, we shouldn't need to be turning the switch off. It should happen through other measures, and that's I think where the government's failing, and actually where it will become more difficult with the public, you know, when we get to 2030. I'm hoping not, but you know, they're making the pathway more, they're doing it in every single sector. Actually, they're making the steeper pathway later, they're leaving the harder decisions for later. And that's what
I mean, it was interesting to read the report and kind of when I saw the 2030 year around the banning of ICE vehicles, my ears pricked up a little bit. Have you had any resistance from any particular areas of industry when we brought that forward again from 2035, or was that just widely accepted as the right thing to do?
Not really. I mean, I'm not sure where Costa Rica are now, but Costa Rica were due to phase out in 2023. There are other countries who've got 2025, 2027 dates. So the global car industry is, you know, coming round to this. And you can see it that you know, so Nissan are committed to becoming a fully electric manufacturer. I can't remember the date. I think it might be 2030, actually. And others are moving in that direction. So we're seeing quite a quick move. You know, it's a bit like the turn of the 20th century, when, you know, people who made carriages and carts that horses drew very quickly moved their coach making to the horseless carriage.
Yeah.
So that was our last innovation, if you like, and it happened very quickly. Hopefully this one will happen just as quickly. Imagine, you know, if you got to 1900 and 1910 and went round, I think you'd probably find it very different in 1910 than it was in 1900.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of people get bogged down in the thinking around it all. I think just ultimately when that thinking is done, then once everyone realizes the right thing to do, then the pace of it just accelerates. Yeah, so it's positive. So I think you're right. I think probably we'll see a significant hockey stick of growth, I think, in EV sales over the course of the next 5 to 10 years and beyond that, to be honest with you, if everything's going to go EV. Just moving over to residential heating now, it'll account for a further 100 terawatt hours of power in 2050 versus today. And the demand will be stronger, so homes will be smarter and they're more connected to the network to manage the bi-directional power flow. You know, you've got an EV or you may have some photovoltaics on the roofs of your house, so all of a sudden the network becomes a lot more complex. Just wondering, how do you think house builders and developers in general have embraced the concept of smart homes and buildings, and also just to like an add on there around the e-mobility in general?
I think that the energy providers and the grid and Northern Power Grid, etc., have and are really well on with this and understand flexibility and bi-directional the movement of electricity and all the rest of it. And car manufacturers as well, I think, particularly Tesla at the front of this, understand that their battery technology in the car is a potential power source as well. The grid's moving that way. It's interesting, I've just got a Google Nest thermostat and we're still coming to terms with that. And it is sort of the heating turns itself on at random times. So I think there probably is a little bit of learning with the home market on smart systems. We're getting there. But in terms of the housing developers, I'm not seeing a lot of movement. You know, we still see houses in Leeds being built with the legal minimum amount of insulation, nowhere near passive house, wouldn't cost them very much more to do, without solar, without hot water heaters, without heat pumps or any of that technology, still using traditional, you know, combis with, you know, traditional central heating. And you know, I'm one of the people that got the council change its policy to it was a bit weaker than I'd like. Basically, if you're building over 50 units, the local councillors can request that EV charging is built as standard. So, like, there's a block of flats on Stonegate Road, which is a council ward.
It
was one of the first that had to have EV charging in 2016. They got the planning permission because I insisted on it as a local councillor and also the person that brought the policy in. And I'm not sure. But really, if local councillors aren't insisting on that, it doesn't have to happen. It should be by default. And that's just a Leeds policy, and obviously every other local authority as well. So I don't think the house builders are in the right place, but we are doing everything we can to encourage them. But the government, I'm afraid to say, moving further and further, they've cancelled two low-carbon home schemes. The co-sustainable homes, which the Labour government legislated for but didn't bring in, but then was scrapped after the 2010 general election. Then the zero carbon home scheme, which was the coalition built up, and then was scrapped after the 2015 election.
Right.
Anyway, I can't remember which one, 2015 it was. So the house builders being allowed to get away with it, and you could surmise the reasons why, and I wouldn't want to speculate too much on those, but they definitely are, much more than other sectors.
Do you think the government could play more of a central government could play more of a role here, or do you think it's with the local government? Obviously, because you've been very proactive, obviously, in your ward and within the city and driving that change, and it's proven it works. Do you think there needs to be some sort of central government policy to start stimulate, I don't know, to stimulate the activity of the house developers? Or
I mean, the government have now again brought out another set of proposals, the zero carbon ready home, which is, due to be implemented. So they need to be 75 to 80% lower than current levels by 2025. So again, they pushed, you know, the sort of, they pushed it back. And let's see if it's 2025, obviously is going to be after the next general election. So let's see, hopefully it, you know, we'll get my first point of view change of government and we'll bring it something even better in. But they're already getting backlash from the housing developers.
Right.
So there already is that tension, but we need to have a very strong zero carbon homes policy. We should have had it 10 years ago. We're already 10 years behind and going to have to wait another 5 years. And the planet can't wait, to be frank.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. The clock is ticking, definitely. No, well, you know, and obviously I think I'm booked to you for 1:30. I really appreciate your time this afternoon. It's wonderful to listen to someone who's got such progressive ideas around about decarbonisation and the green industrial revolution. So, no, thank you very much, and I appreciate your time. As a reminder, in the run-up to COP26 in November 2021, we're launching the podcast series, The Drive to Net Zero. In each instance, we'll have a notable speaker from across the energy industry talking about the very latest in legislation and thought leadership, whilst we explore all areas of decarbonising the UK and Ireland's economy and infrastructure, and we'd love you to join us on that journey. So we look forward to joining you on that digital adventure, and we hope to see you soon.